Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How you doing? Welcome back to the work week, everybody. It is Monday morning, and that theme, of course, means that it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Every Monday morning, we review the new movies. It's Eric Childress and Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com and RogerEbert.com. They join me every week for the new movies, and then Eric and I stick around and talk about the box office. We are headlong into the summer. And we got a lot of movies to talk about in box office and cool stuff like that. It is Monday. That also means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And last night, ABC, in their prime time, dedicated their primetime hours to classic game shows that have been, you know, rebooted with new hosts and new stars. I had a blast watching them. It included Family Feud, the $100,000 Pyramid, and, of course, the greatest game show on earth, Match Game. So we're going to talk about that. The resurgence in popularity of classic game shows, and we'll talk about classic game shows in general. It's one of my favorite topics, and we do have a list of some of the greatest, the weirdest, and the worst game shows of all time, and we want you to join us at all times. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Facebook.com/Nick D Show is our Facebook page. All right, let's get the movie reviews going. Here's Eric Childress. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin Suter. Hi, Colin.
Hello there.
All right, gentlemen. Let's get started. We got some movies to talk about, including one that debuted on that premiered just this weekend on Netflix called The Fundamentals of Caring. And I know that Eric, you saw it at Sundance.
Yep.
And reviewed it back then.
Mm-hmm.
On the show. Colin, have you seen it?
I have not.
Okay. We'll review that a little bit later on. So we've got that and some of the other big ones to talk about, and of course box office. So that's all coming up right here. How did you guys not see Free State of Jones?
It was screened against something else this week, and I just never got to around. I had to choose between that and one of the other films we're about to review.
Yeah.
And I was more intrigued by the one we're about to review, so that's what I chose.
Okay. And Eric, you just didn't get to it?
It was kind of the same thing. Like the two screenings Wednesday night I couldn't get to, and then they added another screening to Free State on Monday afternoon. But I was already committed to a screening Monday night of something else we're going to review.
Okay.
And just going back and forth on a Monday at that time is just not exactly feasible.
No, I understand. I totally understand. Yeah. It's just, you know, I mean, you didn't get to it like America.
Right.
they didn't get to it either.
No.
I did. I mean, you know, it's McConaughey. So
right.
Here's the interesting thing. Colin, I think the movie that you chose to see was at the Music Box, and it was a documentary. That's my guess.
Correct.
Right. I chose Free State of Jones because
okay.
I knew you guys were going to cover it. I knew Eric had already seen it, and I knew, Colin, I figured you were going to go and see it. So I chose Free State of Jones. So I'll review it very quickly. It is, as people have known, it's a Civil War drama based on a true story out of Mississippi. It takes place in during the Civil War. And Matthew McConaughey plays a guy who is a medic for the Confederate Army. And the movie opens with actually a really pretty beautifully staged war sequence. He sees the horrors on the field and sees what's going on in the world, the unjust, what's happening during the Civil War, obviously, and decides he doesn't want to really be a part of it anymore. His nephew dies in a battle. He goes back to Jones County, Mississippi, and sees what's happening there. Decides that that's it. He doesn't want to be a part of this anymore. And he leads a resistance, with some other people who have deserted. Some slaves, some runaway slaves, and they declare this area the Free State of Jones County. They don't want to be a part of the war. They don't want to be part of any of it anymore. This, of course, complicates a lot of matters with his family, with the people that get involved with him, the slaves and the former soldiers. He's an outlaw. At times the film feels a little bit like a mythical, you know, Western Shane-like thing, which is my favorite part of the film. It does sort of dabble in that Western kind of feel to it. Gary Ross made this movie. And Gary, this guy, Eric and Colin, he's got kind of an interesting career, don't you think? Like, if you look at the stuff he's directed, he's kind of all over the map. You can't really pin this guy down. I mean, he did the first Hunger Games movie. And
right,
you know, and Seabiscuit, and did he do Pleasantville, or am I nuts?
Yes.
So I mean,
and he co-wrote Big.
That's right. So this is an interesting kind of movie. For him to do. It's not great. There are some problems with it. It runs 2 hours and 19 minutes, and this is one of those deals. And this is interesting when this happens because it's 2 hours and 19 minutes, and it feels short shifted. It's one of those movies that has a long running time, but could have been longer because there's a lot of stuff going on, and a lot of it is sort of cliff notes or quickly gone through. I think he wanted to touch on as much as possible. And from what I've read, after I saw the film, I read a little bit about the background on it. He hired evidently like the best Civil War historians of all time to be on set as tech advisors. And because he wanted to make it as accurate as absolutely possible. So I think there's a lot of Civil War, people out there, historians, Civil War nuts, Civil War reenactors out there, who I think are going to have a good time watching this movie. Now, I don't necessarily think it needs to be as long as Gettysburg was. but I think just a little bit of it, I think supporting characters don't get as much as they should. It never really, what's really interesting about the movie is that, on the onset, when you look at it, like you read about it, your Matthew McConaughey is the big star. And maybe even if you look at the commercials, you think white guy saves blacks. You know what I mean? Like they're always, whenever there's a movie like this, it's always told from the white perspective.
Yeah.
And that's usually a big complaint and a justified complaint as to, for God's sake, Cry Freedom. That movie became about Kevin Kline and his family without getting killed. So it became about the white family, not Stephen Biko. Stephen Biko dies halfway through the film. And then it becomes about white people getting out. This movie, it doesn't really feel like that at all. It doesn't feel like, look at the white guy speaking up for the black guys and look at the wonderful black people, and I'm using quotes here. Look at the wonderful black people helping the flawed white guy be a better person, which is what it could have fallen into. And that's why the mythical part of the movie is the stuff that I like, the stuff that's sort of played like a great old Western, like The Searchers, or especially there were parts of the movie that totally reminded me of Shane. Overall, I guess I'm going to recommend it. McConaughey's terrific in it, as usual. I mean, he's really, really good in the film. He looks the part. His accent is really good. He interacts very well with everybody in the cast. There's not a lot of a lot of big names in the cast at all, but Gary Ross did a really nice job directing it. He also wrote the screenplay, and he brought in, like I said, he brought in some amazing historians who really helped make the film feel authentic. That I just had issues with, some of the stuff that gets short shifted. It's not a great movie. It's flawed, but I guess I'll recommend it. It's like a 2.5. star thing for me, so I'm being really wishy-washy about it, but I think McConaughey is good, and if you're a big fan of Matthew McConaughey, you should see it. And I also think that if you are a Civil War nut, if you are a Civil War historian really, really interested in it, I think this is a movie that people will see because it feels accurate. And then in reading about it, like I said, Gary Ross went out of his way to make it accurate. Now, here's a question that I have, Eric. We're going to talk about the box office. The thing did terrible over the weekend. It only made $7.7 million. Why would they release this movie the last weekend of June? What is that all about? Why did this not come out in October or November?
The latter part I can't really answer. The first part I can say is because they moved it back from May 13th. So it was actually supposed to open in the beginning of the summer. And they pushed it back to here. And, usually, you have a film like that to open in the summer, it usually means one of two things. One, they're either just trying to create some sort of adult distraction from all the, all the big special effects movies that are coming out.
Right.
Or two, it's just the idea that it looks like a prestige film, feels like a prestige film, but they realize that it's not going to win any Oscars. So why bother putting it into the prestige season?
Well, okay, that the latter part is the truth. Had this movie come out in October or November, McConaughey would not get nominated. There's no question about it.
This factored into it, but now you have The Birth of a Nation from Sundance opening around that time too, which has in some ways a similar storyline in a way.
Right.
So it would have made even less sense.
Right. Okay. Well, I don't know. It just seems stupid to me to release this movie the same day that Independence Day sequel comes out. I don't know. It just seems really.
It's well, like, maybe that was the strategy.
I guess, yeah.
Independence Day.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, Free State of Jones. If you want to see it, you could do a lot worse. It's a flawed movie, but you know McConaughey's great in it, and it has some moments and some really good battle sequences. I do want to say the opening of this movie is really pretty great. So, all right, there you go. So that's Free State of Jones, and I'm not recommending it. So, anyway, real quickly, Gary Ross, what was his first movie?
Pleasantville.
Pleasantville was his first movie, and
he had
he had written stuff before that. You mentioned Big,
yeah.
But Pleasantville was the first. Boy, what a movie out of the gate!
Yeah.
Wow. Does that? I haven't seen that movie in a while. Does it still hold up?
Yep.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, it does. Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. I was a real big fan of that movie when I haven't seen it in years, but.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't direct a whole lot. I mean, it was that, it was Seabiscuit, Hunger Games, and this. And he's doing Ocean's Ocho next.
Right.
Yeah, which that should be fun.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Tell everybody what that is, Eric. What is?
Well, that's they're rebooting. Well, I mean, everyone uses the word rebooting now, but right. They're doing basically Ocean's 11, but with women.
Okay.
Well, so Sandra Bullock is going to be Danny Ocean's sister.
Okay. All right. I'm looking at I just looked it up. Helena Bonham Carter and Elizabeth Banks are also in it?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And Mindy Kaling and, I believe, Cate Blanchett.
Oh, well, I'm in.
Right.
Now, where
are the only five of them.
Where are the pissed off guys on the internet? Are the pissed off guys? Are the Ghostbuster idiots all mad about this?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
All right. Okay.
I don't care either.
I don't either. Here's the thing about that. All the guys that are pissed off about Ghostbusters. I really have a bad feeling about the movie. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I hope it's good because I would love to just throw it back in their faces.
Yes.
But I have a bad feeling. I just think it's going to be a bad movie. It has nothing to do with the sex of the Ghostbusters. It has nothing to do with the women. It just looks bad.
Yeah.
So, but I hope it's good. Anyway, Ocean's Ocho.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, there you go. All right, you guys, hang on. We got a break for the news, all right? We'll come back, and then all of us will review movies. And we got some box office to talk about as well. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com and RogerEbert.com join me every Monday morning. We'll take a break for the news when we come back, more movie reviews. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Hope everybody is well. It's Monday morning, and that's why you hear these theme songs, meaning that it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. I'm Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich at 5 with the opening bell, and my buddy, the great Steve Cochran at 6. We are going to talk about the resurgence in popularity of classic game shows. ABC, last night, all of their primetime was dedicated to some classic game shows rebooted, as they would be. And we're going to talk about that and classic game shows from the past and all that cool stuff. Game show talk, which is I love talking about that. That's coming up. My dad will tell a joke as well. All right, let's get back to the movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning for the movie reviews. And let's welcome them back to the show. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right. Well, Colin, tell us about Tickled. Now, this is the movie that last week when we saw De Palma at the Music Box, they showed a trailer for it, a documentary, mm-hmm. and both you and I, we were sitting next to each other. I can speak for you as well. I think we were both incredibly intrigued by this really great trailer for this documentary. So tell us about it.
Yeah. So, all right. So it's a documentary about a newspaper reporter. Well, he's a reporter, internet reporter, maybe, I guess, in New Zealand, who is also the director of this documentary and the producer, and he is a co-producer and director as well. And he specializes in finding weird, obscure sort of gatherings and weird people and things on, you know, weird things people do on the internet. And he comes across this website that is devoted to competitive tickling endurance videos. Basically, people get filmed being tickled by three or four people while, you know, being strapped to a chair, and it's a bit of a strange fetish, I guess, that some people who visit the website might have, get turned on watching this sort of thing. But it seems pretty harmless, even if it's absurd. When the journalist investigates it, though, and wants to know more about it, he sends a rather cryptic and threatening letters from the woman who runs the website, insisting that if he investigates even further, bad things will happen. So naturally, being, you know, the journalist, he gets even more curious, and he decides to go ahead with making a documentary about his investigation into the matter, because he's never received a threatening letter like this before, or letters. They keep coming the more he asks questions. So he and his partner investigate, and they go, you know, the investigation takes them to the United States, you know, takes them to New York and Michigan. And the further down the rabbit hole he goes, you know, the weirder the story gets. And that's all I'm going to say about it. This is one of those movies that is a real treat to watch unfold. It does so with a really kind of, you know, skill of investigative journalism. You really do want to know more with every kind of layer that's peeled back. You know, with every layer that's peeled back, it reveals a lot more questions that you want to see answered. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, the journalist is also the filmmaker and the narrator. And there weren't too many times when I was, you know, not trusting of it. There are a lot of, you know, moments where they try to confront certain people and they just don't get very far. And it's not too much I can say about it without revealing stuff. So
right.
I have to be kind of cagey about my review here.
Right.
But by the end, I will say this, by the end, it's a really compelling, really interesting story. But I also thought on my way home, thinking about it, thinking it's probably more common than we think. You know, there's probably things that happen here that are probably, I feel like I've seen this kind of thing unfold before, but that's not the detriment to the film or the fault of anybody. You know, it's just that kind of weird feeling that I have. Nevertheless, I do recommend this film quite a bit.
Okay. All right. All right, Eric, you saw this at a fest, right?
No, actually. I saw it a few weeks ago.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I like the film. I don't think I quite like it quite as much as Colin. As a film, watching this thing unfold, like Colin said, it's really just kind of fascinating to see just, you know, where the rabbit hole leads this journalist David Ferrier, and so you're engrossed in the 90 minutes or however long it is that you're sitting there, you're just sort of fascinated and you're sort of hypnotized by where the next discovery is going to be. But by the when it was all over and you just sort of get to the end of it, there's almost sort of almost like a sense of disappointment in a way, in that you think about some of the things that weren't followed up on during the film. Particularly, there's a trio of lawyers that he meets with earlier in the film that really kind of get forgotten about, unless you look up some of the screenings that have happened recently. You'll see those lawyers reappear again. But and like Colin said, I think he's absolutely right in that, you know, I think that this movie actually works sort of better as a sort of a case study in sort of the false promise of the internet, particularly when it comes to threats and scams and things like that. I think that's the bigger lesson that gets unfolded here. Because I know, you know, some people have been afraid to play this film in some cases because of being, you know, threatened with lawsuits and things happening to their families and their private accounts and all these things that they promised to hack and all these things like that that end up. And then, you know, by the end, you're just kind of like, okay, there's just sort of, you know, crazy people in the world who like to, you know, have a lot of time in their hands and like to write letters. So, yeah, I mean, as a film, as a 90-minute film, it's just sort of, it's kind of a fascinating ride. You'll think about it for a little bit, and then you'll just kind of forget about it for, you know, until a better documentary comes along. So I'm recommending it as a sort of a one-timer.
Okay. All right, so that's Tickled. It's only playing at the Music Box, and if you're interested in discovering the world of mysterious tickling competitions, this is your movie. So it's at the Music Box, and it's called Tickled. All right. Eric,
Yeah.
Let's talk about this movie that debuted on Netflix this weekend.
The Fundamentals of Caring.
Yeah. Now let me ask you this: you saw this film at Sundance, was it already a Netflix movie, or did Netflix pick it up?
It was picked up there.
Ah. Okay.
Yeah. This was the Sundance. If you remember, where all of a sudden not just Netflix but Amazon started really getting into the game. In fact, I mean the purchases, or at least Amazon and Netflix, and there was some of the deals were just they have the home video rights, but not the theatrical rights. I mean, it's business and whatnot.
Did the Neon Demon play at these fests and get picked up by Amazon? Is that how that happened?
That actually premiered at Cannes. And I think Amazon already had it.
Oh, okay.
Somebody must have seen it beforehand or somehow and bought it there. But cause when Neon Demon played at Cannes, I guess they already had the marketing materials ready to go as soon as the premiere happened.
All right, okay. And again, from what I understand, it got booted off the screen.
Well, what doesn't at Cannes?
That's true. Frankly. Okay, so this was an independent film. Netflix picked it up at Sundance, and it's called The Fundamentals of Caring. Tell us about it.
Okay. This film, it was written and directed by Rob Burnett, who was for many years David Letterman's producer. And this is a story of Paul Rudd plays a guy who's looking for a new job after tragedy in his life and a divorce he's going through, though he still won't sign the divorce papers. And he takes a job, takes some classes to be a caregiver. And he ends up getting a job with mother and her son, her more than teenage son, I believe, who's got cystic fibrosis or
no, it's muscular dystrophy.
Muscular dystrophy. Right. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I just watched it yesterday, so it's fresh in my head.
I think it's even more complicated than that, but that's essentially
There's more. There's a little more to it than that, but
right.
Yeah. But I mean, I know you haven't seen this movie since February, so
yeah.
I saw it. I saw it 20 hours ago.
Right, there you go. And he's played by Craig Roberts. He's in a wheelchair and whatnot. And as characters like this in movies like this is particularly difficult to deal with. He doesn't exactly want a caregiver. He's driven many caregivers away. And Paul Rudd, being the first-timer, has to now, deal with this guy's pranks and just, being kind of just a general jackass and whatnot. Eventually, the two of them begin to sort of come to an understanding and understand each other's smart-ass ways. And as they become closer, Paul Rudd actually gets his mom and him to agree to take him on a road trip, to actually take him to a lot of these places that he's marked on a map and places that he'd love to visit. And they convince him to do this, and then also on the way, possibly visit his father, who he has not seen in some time. So, if this sounds like a movie that you've seen probably six times this year, well, maybe you haven't, but I certainly have. Although this was one of the first ones that I saw, and once Netflix bought the movie. I began telling people that, basically I've been describing this movie as the perfect Netflix movie, and that it's you don't have to do a lot of heavy lifting watching it. It deals with certain subject matters, but not the kind of, stuff that's going to send you into depression for a week. It deals with those matters, but it deals with a lot of humor. And obviously you have Paul Rudd at the center of it, who is capable of doing just about anything, comedy or drama. And just about a lot of stuff that Paul Rudd does in the movie is pretty terrific. And I think him and Craig Roberts have really good chemistry. And I think when the two of them are on screen, the film works. It starts to get a little cagey later on when they pick up a couple of strays along the way, one played by Selena Gomez, who I think is very miscast in the film as this runaway who then sparks the the fire under Craig Robertson's chair, and another a pregnant woman whose husband is serving overseas, and I don't think that storyline works at all. But I think this is sort of the perfect Netflix movie. It's the kind of thing you can put on a weekend afternoon and have more than a few laughs with. Enjoy Paul Rudd's work. And then just kind of, you know, forget about it as soon as it's over. And you tell people about it, and then they watch it, and then they forget about it. So I enjoyed the film for what it was, and like, I've already forgotten a lot about it.
Okay. I'm going to review it after we take a break. Hold on a second. That's Eric Childress and Colin Suter, and they join me every Monday morning to review movies. The movie that we are talking about is a Netflix movie. It just it was added to Netflix. It debuted this past weekend with Paul Rudd, called The Fundamentals of Caring. So if you have Netflix, that's where it's at. That's where you can find it exclusively on Netflix, The Fundamentals of Caring. And I'll give you my review after we take a break. Welcome back, everybody. It is Monday morning, and that means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. It happens every Monday morning. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more join me every week to review all the new movies. And Eric and I then discuss some box office as well. 312-981-7200 is the text and talk line. We have reviewed the documentary Tickled, Eric and Colin. Colin liked it more than Eric, but they both recommended it. And I reviewed Free State of Jones, the new Matthew McConaughey Civil War film. Not bad, not good. McConaughey's very good. You could do worse. And right now we're talking about the movie The Fundamentals of Caring. And it's a Netflix movie that you can find on Netflix. It just debuted this weekend, starring Paul Rudd. And Eric gave it a good review. All right, welcome back, guys. Eric, I liked it quite a bit more than you did. I really did. I thought it was actually pretty terrific. And one of the things that I found very refreshing about it was that, you know, you think that this, because Paul Rudd plays this character, and God, Paul Rudd is good. I mean, what do we get? You know, he's just great.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just great. He's great in everything. And I love the guy. And, you know, you're kind of left in the dark for a little while as to why this guy is in such a funk. You know, and why he won't sign these divorce papers. And then slowly it's revealed. And I think that's done really nicely, the tragedy that's revealed slowly. And, you know, when he first gets the job, he just, you know, he there's a reason why he takes this job as a caregiver. And that's another thing mm-hmm. that's also revealed in the film. But one of the things I like, by the way, I want to mention the Jennifer, how do you pronounce her last name? Ely?
Yeah.
Who plays the kid's
yes,
mother?
Plays the mom. I couldn't think of who it was.
She is great. Great. It's a wonderful performance. And the relationship between her and the kid is so terrific and refreshing. Because the entrance that the kid makes when she's interviewing Paul Rudd, because he's a first-time caregiver, and so mm-hmm. she's interviewing him to try to find out. And the entrance the kid makes, I don't know if you remember, Eric, but he's pretending to be far worse off
yes.
than he really is. And
mm-hmm.
it's just and the fact that the mother cracks up at that.
Right.
Right there was like, okay, this is going to be a very unique mother-son relationship. This is not going to be the, you know, the usual cliched mother-sick kid relationship.
Right.
And it's not. And I love that. I thought that was so refreshing. And then as the movie goes on, you know, the struggle that Paul Rudd has to deal with this kid and deal with this really complex job where, and he keeps being reminded by the kid who is, I think, great, Craig Roberts,
mm-hmm.
great. He's great in this movie. Who constantly is being reminded that he's basically getting paid $9 an hour to wipe his butt. That is like repeated a bunch of times in the
yeah.
film. And so, but the thing is, like, that part of the movie lasts about 10 minutes. Like, they do like a, you know, they do like this montage of him struggling to make the food and to do this for this kid and to, you know, to work with the medication and all that stuff. And then that stuff's over and Paul Rudd becomes as a-hole-ish and cynical as the kid.
Yeah.
And that's such a refreshing way to do it. And there is a moment in the movie where he discovers that the kid, Trevor, knew about his tragedy. And he busts into the kid's room and goes off on him.
Yep.
And that scene, you don't see that kind of stuff in these kind of movies. Like a really honest and vulgar, I mean, there are F-bombs dropping all over this movie. And this relationship between this caregiver and this kid is so far from cliche and so unique and awesome. And I agree with you, the best stuff in this movie is between the two of them. I like Selena Gomez in it. I actually liked her very much. The pregnant girl thing doesn't work.
No.
That, to me, that's the one flaw in the movie, and it leads up to a relatively preposterous climax.
Yeah, of course.
But it had to happen, and there had to be some resolution in Paul Rudd's, you know, mind as to the tragedy that befell his family.
Mm-hmm.
So that all came together. I think they could have went another route with it. It didn't hurt the movie for me, though. Like I said, I like Selena Gomez, and these two guys, this Craig Roberts kid is great, and Paul Rudd is great. It was refreshing and funny. There's some stuff in this movie, because they basically, it turns into a road trip movie. I mean, for the most part, it becomes a road trip movie. And there are things in this movie that just were, that had me on the floor. They go and visit these roadside attractions, because the kid would just constantly sit in, never leave the house. He was terrified to leave the house. He would never leave the house and watch TV and mark on the map these things that he saw on TV, these ridiculous roadside attractions. So they go see, at one point, they go to see the biggest bovine on the planet named Rufus. I don't know if you remember this, Eric.
Yes, I do.
They go and they drive all the way there, and you know, and they find out that it's not handicap accessible. Like, they keep Rufus on the second floor.
Yeah.
And so Rudd goes nuts and starts swearing at him. And he's like, I'm going to call the newspapers and they're all going to come down here. And at one point, the kid goes, actually, what number are you calling? Really? Seriously, what are you doing? Like, he's mocking him. So he's screaming at the guy, you know, that you know, this is unbelievable. It's your fault. You know, this kid is not going to be able to see the biggest bovine in the world. And so they're like, you're going to make restitution. You're going to let us see that bovine. So they do a shot and they do a jump cut, Eric, to four guys carrying the wheelchair up the stairs.
Yes.
And it's like, literally, it's a 15-second shot. Like, oh, God, I'm slipping. Oh, put it up. And then they're carrying him up the stairs. And then there's that wonderful scene where they finally get to see Rufus. And there are the close-ups of the bull's eyes and the two guys' eyes. And that scene is hilarious. And then smash cut again, them taking the wheelchair down the stairs. And those two jump cuts, I don't know if I laughed my ass off.
My favorite line in the movie actually concerns Paul Rudd and the patty melt.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. So there's a bunch of stuff in this movie. It does, you know, I mean, like, the emotional payoff at the end with the pregnant girl is, you know, it was inevitable that was going to happen. But overall, I found this movie to be really refreshing. I was moved by it. I laughed a lot. And again, I can't speak enough about how great the performances are. Craig Roberts, this kid, is tremendous in this movie. And the relationship with Paul Rudd and him is so refreshing and vulgar and funny. And every time the kid choked, I was there's a sequence that involves a Slim Jim. The first time he ever eats a Slim Jim. I don't want to give anything away. But anyway, I really enjoyed it. I did. I liked it more than you did, Eric. I think it's a better film than you're giving it credit for. And again, I did. And I, you know what the thing is, Eric, I did exactly what you said. What people should do.
Right.
It was a Sunday afternoon, and I watched it on Netflix.
That's right, and you enjoyed the hell out of it.
Exactly.
Perfect Netflix movie.
All right. Okay. Okay, Eric, hang on. Colin, hang on. We got a break here for the news, and then we'll come back, and we've got the big Hollywood movies to review. But seriously, Eric liked it. I really, really, really liked it, and I'm highly recommending The Fundamentals of Caring on Netflix. All right, we'll take a break. The news is next. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. I'm your overnight dude, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. weekday mornings. Here till 5, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. And the one, the only, the great Steve Cochran at 6. 312-981-7200, talk and text. Check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And later on, my dad will tell a joke, because it's a jokey time on Monday morning. And because ABC has brought back some game shows, classic game shows, we are going to talk about the ABC lineup from last night. And classic game shows in general, the best, the worst, the most memorable, your favorites. I love talking game shows, and they're more popular than ever now. And so we'll talk about that. All right. But right now, we're getting back to the movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning from efilmcritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more. And we welcome these guys back. All right. Okay. Hi. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right. Well, Colin, you know, I'm going to let you and Eric, you guys can both enjoy handling Independence Day Resurgence, because I didn't go and see it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I saw you guys post some stuff online, and I went, yeah, I'm not going to go. Considering I absolutely hate the first movie. Absolutely hate it. Find it xenophobic and misogynistic and stupid. borderline racist. I hate everything about that first movie. So any excuse not to see this one, and I saw you guys had already seen it. You're covering it right now, so I stayed away.
Well, you pretty much reviewed it anyway. you pretty much did our job for us in that little few seconds there. But anyway, we'll go through it anyway.
Okay.
This is the, thoroughly unnecessarily sequel, again, directed by Roland Emmerich. Jeff Goldblum and Judd Hirsch and Bill Pullman, they've all returned, among a few other people, but no Will Smith. Will Smith has been replaced by a bunch of young actors filling in for that role of military personnel who know how to fly fighter jets. There's no reason to get into their background stories. They're predictable. They don't add up to anything, and the less said about them, the better. It's 20 years after the alien invasion, and now America, we've somehow managed to use the alien technology to our advantage, and now we got flying ships everywhere, and scientists come in contact with another, alien ship way out there that, oh my God, how did we miss this? And now there's a new threat to civilization that might be bigger and better than the aliens we saw in the first Independence Day movie. Jeff Goldblum, who in the first film, if I remember correctly, played a cable repairman.
I don't even remember. Right? I have no memory.
He worked for the cable company.
Right, and now he's the chief alien defense expert working for the president. Bill Pullman is, of course, no longer president, but inserts himself in the situation because he, gave a grandiose speech last time and has to do something. So he shaves off his beard and joins in. So this is we said this last week, this is the most expensive movie ever made to not be screened for critics. And there's a lot of, reason for that. I mean, strange when you consider that, even all the Transformer movies are screened for critics. But this is, the same kind of level of incompetence and stupidity. And the kind of incompetence and stupidity you expect from Roland Emmerich, who has made a career out of just blowing things up. And this one, he pretty much just blew up his own franchise. I'm not a fan of the first Independence Day either. But any movie that makes it look competent and entertaining on a so bad it's good level is cause for some kind of alarm.
God.
Whatever talent he had as an action filmmaker, let's forget about the story. I mean, you could poke holes in that forever. Whatever talent he might have had, and it's minimal, as an action director, is totally absent. I mean, he has totally lost it. Like, the action scenes have no coherence to them. You have no idea, when all the fighter pilots are out there shooting at things, you have no idea what they're shooting at, who's chasing them, who the good guys are, who the bad guys are. You're completely lost. All the performances here are ridiculous, but especially Pullman. Pullman's performance is out and out laughable. And he's playing the same part he played, before, but now he's like kind of senile or something, and it's just absolutely absurd. Like, the physical performance he's giving is absolutely laughably bad. It's a $200 million budget. You'd think with that kind of money, they could come up with at least one good, solid green screen effect. Every shot in this movie, you feel like they're on a cheap soundstage. You can see where the green screen begins and the reality ends. And, it's just, I'm sure Eric will find a lot more to go on. But I'm saying this is a movie that achieves a lot of screenwriting low points, a lot of directorial embarrassments. And this is pretty much an embarrassment for all the talent involved. This never should have happened. And they leave it open for a third one, which is really absurd because nobody here is interested in even being in this movie or even making it. Roland Emmerich doesn't even give a crap about this movie. And so this is there's a reason why Fox is hiding it, and there's a reason why it bombed this weekend. So, okay. Yeah.
All right, Eric.
Yeah, like Colin said, there's plenty of incompetence to go around to cover two reviews here. The one positive thing that I can say about this movie is its optimism. And by that I mean that you know, because the movie makes no qualms about suggesting that the original movie happened in 1996. We keep hearing people say, back in 96, back in 96, back in 96, as if to remind us that we saw maybe a competent movie 20 years ago. And so they keep referencing that, and we're, you know, in the 20 years, even though we've gotten this alien technology, you have to consider that the entire world was pretty much blown up 20 years ago, and yet somehow everyone has managed to pull together to now, you know, craft all the alien technology so we have a moon base with flying spaceships that, you know, they're like flying spaceships around the White House, for God's sakes. You know, it took us 10 years to rebuild the World Trade Center, okay? So the blind optimism in this film is somewhat charming, but, you know, completely idiotic. Beyond that, this movie, if you remember the Yada Yada episode of Seinfeld.
Yes, I do.
Okay. mind you, there's a lot of yada yada in this movie. Okay. But if you remember, one of the running jokes of that particular episode was that George was able to find Jerry no matter where he was.
Right, yeah.
Okay, he's in the dentist's office, then he's in the confessional,
right,
and George
right.
is just always popping up. This entire movie is like that. That when Colin said that during the action sequences, you don't know where anyone is, yet the entire movie, characters, groups of characters who are seemingly in completely, you know, like in outer space or by the White House or whatnot, they keep managing to connect scene to scene. Like, wait, how did Goldblum and Hemsworth, they were just in outer space. How are they in the Situation Room at this point? William, during this movie, because he gives a performance of, like, he is just, like, halfway crying through all of his scenes, and yet he becomes the president, Ed, in between scenes. I'm trying to think of just all the things that do not work in this movie, and there's pretty much nothing. There's no coherence to the story. Colin didn't even mention the fact there's a second alien technology that shows up and speaks English because it's managed to download our Siri, basically. It's got the big giant ball that has the voice of Siri, giving us the technology necessarily to beat the other aliens and whatnot. We don't know why the aliens are really here. They're introducing characters 52 minutes in the movie after all the attacks have taken place, as if we're supposed to go like, oh yeah, now we're supposed to care about these kids whose parents are in Florida, and they none of them have a driver's license, but they went on vacation to Florida, and then they have to rescue Judd Hirsch, and then Judd Hirsch has to rescue them, and then they're all staying together at the end, presumably so Judd Hirsch can reenact the movie Room. I sat there in just kind of slack-jawed amazement that anyone thought that this movie was ready to be put out. And when Colin mentioned that they throw in this, like, hey, we're going to make a third movie, and Brett Spiner comes out, and he's, oh, we're gonna, you know, guys, look what we can do. Like, we're going to go on this another adventure. And, of course, everyone, the world's been blown up again, and all the principals are just like, yeah, sure, okay, we'll do it. It's like, okay,
yeah.
There were audible groans in the audience that I saw with Thursday Night.
Yeah.
Like, oh, are you kidding me? We got to sit through another one of these? And they were all there willingly, too. These are people who were clearly fans.
Yeah.
They had brought kids and stuff of the original movie. And, you know, this movie deserves to die 1,000 deaths.
Okay. Well, it only made $41 million over the weekend, so
we'll
talk about that later. All right, Eric, Colin, hang on. They did not like Independence Day Resurgence at all. Okay. We'll take a break. We got more movies to talk about right here on WGN. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And it's Monday morning, and that means it's time to review movies. Monday morning movie reviews continue. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com and RogerEbert.com join me every Monday to review the new movies. Let's get back to it. And Eric and Colin, welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Okay, Eric.
Yeah.
tell us about the Neon Demon.
Okay. Well, this is the new film from Nicholas Winding Refn, who gave us probably most known for Drive, and then his last film was Only God Forgives. But he's back now with this story that's set amongst the modeling industry. It stars Elle Fanning as a 16-year-old girl who is has taken some photographs from a guy online that she likes a little bit. And she gets noticed that she seems to have that it quality that the people in the modeling industry are looking for. Just very naturalistic, not fake, not plastic at all. Just has just the perfect blend of natural beauty. So she's in Los Angeles and hanging out at a really Fleabag hotel that's run by Keanu Reeves. And she immediately gets a modeling contract, or at least gets some gigs. And this sort of puts, you know, the competition on edge a little bit. There are a pair of models played by Bella Heathcote and Abby Lee, who is in Mad Max Fury Road, who you see her clearly as a threat. They've had a lot of work done themselves, and you know, see this person as possibly cutting into their gigs and whatnot. And there's also another girl played by Jenna Malone. Who has her own claim in the modeling world. She does the makeup for a lot of the models, but also for she works in a mortuary and puts the makeup on corpses. So you have all these characters set up in if you're familiar at all with Nicholas Winding Refn's work. Maybe set up for something really kind of outrageous and violent and maybe even bordering on satire a little bit. And this film clearly wants to do all of those things, but I think fails at just about every opportunity. There's not a lot, there's really nothing in this film that hasn't been said before by any article on the fashion industry. You know, you could watch any episode of America's Next Top Model and probably get a greater sense of rivalry and things that that this film purports to have. But Nicholas Winding Refn has fashioned this in some respect as a horror movie in a way, and we don't want to reveal too much because this movie doesn't really become a horror movie until much later in the proceedings. There's some horror imagery here and there. There's a lot of David Lynch like metaphors, especially involving mountain cats and predators, and Keanu Reeves going all out as a real sleaze bag. All the guys are sleaze bags, and all the women are vapid and competitive and all the cliches that we've come to know about the modeling industry. And by the time it gets to it's the horror aspects that's seemingly should be inherent throughout the entire movie, it's way too little, way too late. And this movie runs 2 hours long, and Refn seems to be in love with his own style of filmmaking at times, that shots, scenes just linger on forever. And again, they don't really add up to much of anything. Keanu Reeves isn't really down with the satire of the movie, I don't think, but he just gives sort of a gloriously, over-the-top performance as the sleazebag manager that I don't think anyone else in the film really rivals. I think Elle Fanning is fine in the film. Jenna Malone, I think I've seen her play this role about four times now, and so there's really no mystery to her character. There are some beautiful imagery in the film, but again, we've seen Nicholas Winding Refn play with neon lights and cinematography before. We've seen him with Cliff Martinez's score before. So, I know this guy's got a following, and when people ask me about him, I say I love Drive, and that's about it. And Neon Demon goes into the that's about it category.
Okay. All right, we're going to break. We'll come back. Colin, you'll tell us what you think, and then I will tell you what I think of The Neon Demon, which inexplicably opened wide this past weekend. And we'll talk more about it coming up here on 720 WGN. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Movie Reviews, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And Eric just gave us his thoughts on The Neon Demon. He hated it, and It's the new Nicholas Winding Refn film with Elle Fanning about it's a drama, thriller, horror movie, something about the fashion industry. Colin, what did you think?
Yeah. kind of with Eric. I think I liked it a little bit more, but I'm still not on board with Refn in general. I think he is a very interesting visual craftsman. I think when he composes shots, there's something, you know, wonderfully unique and mysterious about some of the things he puts on the screen. But it kind of stops with the eye. My brain is not doing any, I don't think he has much of anything interesting to say. I wasn't a huge fan of Drive. I thought it was okay. I thought it was, you know, more style than substance. And I think that's basically sums up his career. I think he is caught up in his imagery and his ideas, but I don't think he really cares that much about his characters that much. And that's the sense that I get when I watch his stuff. I find it also kind of particularly insufferable that he is deciding to put his initials in the beginning of, you know, during the opening credits, you know, while the opening
credits. Oh, and at the end.
And at the end.
Yep.
Which I thought Tarantino was annoying at the beginning of, you know, Kill Bill when he said the fourth film from Quentin Tarantino. You know, just sort of the director announcing himself, you know, right, you know, and putting that at the forefront is just, I think, just is something that really bugs the heck out of me. And now it's like, okay, Refn is declaring himself a brand. And that's what this is really about, apparently. It starts things off on the wrong foot for me. By the end of the movie, I thought, well, there's some really interesting imagery in there. But like Eric said, there's nothing here that I really haven't seen before, in other movies, other, you know, even documentaries. That nothing happened that I didn't expect to happen, either within the story or from Nicholas Winding Refn when he goes off on, you know, certain tangents. So interesting moments, you know, good. If you're gonna see it, you have to see it. I guess see it on the big screen because it's, you know, visually interesting. But by the end, I just kind of walked away not thinking about much of anything.
Okay. I think it's one of the best movies of the year. everything, Colin, especially what you were saying about Nicholas Winding Refn having his initials at the, you know, on the thing, and like I counted, his name is mentioned 8 times in the credits. And that to me adds depth to what this movie is. I think this movie is one of the greatest movies about narcissism ever made, and it's made by clearly the most narcissistic filmmaker who's working today. And to me, that brings an insight into this movie that I think is very, very significant. To me, this is a movie about I think whatever is in Refn's head, whatever is his philosophies on life. This is it. This is the guy. I think this is like one of the most personal films a director has made in a long time. Now, is this a guy I'd want to hang out with or talk with? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's so funny, Colin, because as soon as I saw the initials at the bottom of the screen at the beginning, I'm like, oh God. And then the movie turns out to be about that. It's about that very thing. I thought there was brilliance in this movie. And again, we were all talking about the visuals. The visuals are beautiful. It's incredibly well photographed, beautifully composed. The editing is nice. Everything about this movie is just, you know, in terms of visuals, it's really amazing. I think Elle Fanning is the perfect person to play this role. I don't think she's ever been more expressive. It's like I think one of the most perfectly cast roles I've seen in a movie in a long time. I thought all the surrounding characters were interesting. Jenna Malone has played this kind of role before, although I don't think that she's ever done a scene quite like the one that she gets to do in the mortuary late in the film. And Keanu Reeves is spectacular in it. Keanu Reeves is phenomenal in it. But the movie is told it's told in three parts. There's the first part where she's all wide-eyed and innocent, and she's in this vapid world, this narcissistic, insane world where people do horrible things to each other and to their bodies in order to look beautiful, but really hollow on the inside. And then when she confronts essentially the three-sided neon demon that's visually shown at the beginning of the film and throughout, when she finally confronts it and begins to embrace it, you know, by kissing herself inside the neon demon, that's when the movie takes a sudden turn. That's when her character takes a sudden turn and isn't the same person she was in the first third of the movie. And then because of this turn, the movie takes a stylistic change. The movie becomes more Baroque. There's a lot of stuff in it that, like, you know, at least the first part of the first half hour, 40 minutes of the movie, at least on some semblance, makes sense. In the middle section, it starts to all kind of disintegrate. The narrative starts to get really weird. Things start happening out of nowhere. And it becomes very vague and weird. But in a way where it sacrifices the logic of the script, which is fine with me. And then something happens that triggers the final third of the movie, which is all out horror, all out Grand Guignol horror. And that's my favorite part of the movie. And that to me is the progression the movie makes. I think the final third of this movie is amazing. And I think there is stuff in it. There's a scene in the movie where, and I don't want to give anything away, one of the most hypnotizing and downright creepy scenes in the movie involves a couple of women taking a shower and Jenna Malone in a bathtub. And that sequence is mesmerizing to me. I was hypnotized by it. I found it unbelievably creepy. Not just what was happening, but how there really isn't anything happening on screen. There's nothing really happening in those two shots, because there's basically two shots. There's a shot of two women taking a shower and a shot of Jenna Malone in a bathtub. Nothing really happens, but the way it's put together, the mood of it, they don't really explain what happens. And then there's a jump cut to the two models going off to do a shoot, and then it just gets crazier and crazier. By the end of the movie, when the final image happens, the final moment of the movie happens, it makes complete sense to me. And then at the very end of the movie, he basically starts another, like the movie ends, he dedicates it to his wife, which I think is hilarious. Because it was like, at the end it says, "For Liv." And I'm like, what the hell did this woman do to deserve this movie? And then like a Sia music video kind of begins to end the movie. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then his initials come back on the screen and his name is repeated another eight times. I went, this is an insane movie made by an insane guy whose personality and brains have just been thrown all over this screen. And he is an empty, narcissistic, his world is just really weird and empty and narcissistic. I think it's the best movie ever made about narcissism. And I think to have this movie released in a time where every single person on the planet runs around doing selfies and is more concerned with that kind of crap than what's really happening, I think this movie's brilliant. So anyway.
You could label the three parts of the movie basically Mulholland Drive, Black Swan, and Ravenous.
Well, yeah.
All better films. No,
well, I don't think so, but I agree with you. I totally agree with you. I mean, it's not like he hasn't been influenced by other filmmakers. Clearly, he has. And those three that you mentioned are the guys, you know? And Argento is in there as well, and Michael Mann is in there as well. And Michael Mann, he should have cut a check to Michael Mann for Drive, you know? But it's a great, it doesn't make it not good. You know, Drive is a great film, and I think this is a great film, too. I don't know. And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed Keanu Reeves in it. I can't even explain to you how much I enjoyed him in this movie. Like, his scenes are fantastic and way creepy. Way, way creepy. So anyway, I was hook, line, and sinker, guys. Sorry. I think it's brilliant. So, all right.
Did you hear that, everyone? Nick recommends the Neon Demon.
I do.
That's on him.
No, it's on me, and it's going to be on my – and I guarantee you it'll be on my top 10 list at the end of the year.
Good God.
I guarantee you. I thought it was brilliant and the best movie ever made about narcissism by a true narcissist. So, and I think, Colin, there's an absolute reason why those letters are on the screen. They just, at the end when they came back up, I just started laughing. I was like giddy after watching this insane movie. Basically, it's 2 hours of a guy going, "I'm narcissistic and nuts here."
Yeah.
Anyway, all right.
Exactly.
We'll see.
That's entertainment. Okay.
I thought it was great. Should we break here, Dan? Okay. Eric, Colin, hold on. We got one more movie to talk about, and then we got box office as well. So we'll do the weather and traffic right now. All right. I got the weather right here. Thank you. Oh, excuse me. I thought they were gonna kill me. I think they might still because of that review. I loved it. Esmeralda, it's awesome.
I really want to see it.
Yeah. Don't say I didn't warn you. Because it's crazy. All right. Welcome back, everybody. We're wrapping up the movie reviews. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. So Eric and Colin are back, and we've got one more movie to review. Colin, tell us about The Shallows.
All right. So this is Blake Lively as a medical student. She's on vacation. She goes to in Mexico, and she goes to this little private, little unknown, little secluded beach. She meets a couple of other surfers there, and everything seems fine. And then she's, you know, left alone to surf by herself. And then a shark comes along and, you know, basically attacks her. And she's, you know, she's out and, you know, in, you know, pretty far out, but she's got this little plot of coral or land, that will, you know, that she can rest on and escape from it. And it'll soon be gone in about, like 12 or 15 hours, when the tide gets higher. And in the meantime, she has to figure out how to stay alive, and she has a few items that can help her out, but she really just has to rely on her wits while this shark is basically circling the area. This is a fun little thriller. There's not much to it than that. It's, you know, we've seen a lot of these, you know, one man, one woman survival movies, you know, and this is, you know, this is basically just another one of those. But I think Blake Lively is really good in it. And I think the, you know, when it's just her and the shark and her dealing with the shark, I think the movie is very entertaining. I was kind of on the edge of my seat at certain points. And I think that, you know, for 87 minutes, this you could do a lot worse this summer. I do think the very end of the movie is, you know, unnecessary. There's a coda at the end that I think was, you know, just really does not need to be there. They could have faded out and it would have been a little bit happier about it. I think this is a pretty, you know, mostly solid, except for a few, you know, choices to go slow motion during the action, which always, I've said before, always drives me nuts. But I think it's kept at a minimum amount where it didn't drive me that crazy. I think this is, you know, just a good, solid little 87-minute woman versus shark movie that, you know, for the most part, delivers the goods.
Okay, Eric.
Yeah, to me, this is kind of like the equivalent of vanilla ice cream without the chocolate sauce. It's a very economical film, and it's, you know, there were times that, you know, I was certainly never really bored with the film, but there were so many opportunities that I felt that the film just missed the opportunity to just turn on the cleverness or just, to give us something a little bit extra. The idea that, you know, she could swim to this place, and there's a point where she's, like, timing the shark. You know, I wanted a little bit more of that because there's a lot of her basically sitting on the rock with a pigeon and, waiting.
He's a seagull, man.
Seagull, pigeon, whatever. They're white birds that doesn't do anything.
He's the Wilson of the movie.
Don't even dare. Don't even dare. But anyway, a perfect example for me, like I put out like an audible giggle when there's a moment where she realizes that between her and her destination, there's like a big sea of jellyfish. And I'm just like, oh, okay, here we go. And then the movie kind of fails to deliver on the potential of the thrills of a scene like that. It just kind of gives you a special effects shot and, you know, just the bare minimum. And I think that's kind of what Jaime Soler, whatever, how you pronounce his name, sorry, just kind of gives us throughout the movie. The movie's not bad. It's watchable. If you saw it on cable on weekends, again, it's kind of the perfect Netflix movie. You wouldn't, you know, really bat an eye. But, you know, seeing it in the theater, I was just, like, kept, you know, waiting for it to just give that little extra bit of juice that I thought a better director. I think Blake Lively's good in the movie. I think one of the best moments of the movie is the moment where she has to react to something happening off screen, and we just pull in on her face. Yep. I think that's the best moment in the film. Yep. And unfortunately, we see the tail end of it. But, so I'm like 2.5 stars.
Okay, I liked it a little bit more than you did, Eric. I'm more with Colin on this. I thought it was solid. I thought it was fun. I had a good time watching it, and I think Blake Lively is really good in it. I do think, you know, that there are, you know, the setups in the screenplay are, you know, hey, good thing she was a medical student and has and specifically has those earrings on. You know, when she's got to MacGyver her wound, you know, but I thought some of the stuff was interesting. I liked because he did the same thing, the director, this Colette Sarah guy. He did the same kind of thing with Nonstop, where he had, like, the images from phones and stuff pop up on the screen,
yes.
Which I thought was kind of fun and Nonstop. And I also liked in this, for some reason, you know, it seems like a cheap way to do it. But when the timer pops up on the screen and she's got to swim from the rock to the buoy and back or whatever it was, you know, I thought that was a pretty interesting way to do it. And I thought the little technique of telling the story about the father and the little sister by using the phone and stuff, I thought that was pretty cool. And at the beginning of the movie, when she's getting the ride to the island from the guy, you know, and the little cell phone things pop up, the pictures and things like that, it was kind of economical and kind of clever the way that the story was told. This is not going to change the world by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a good person versus, shark movie. And there were parts of it that I really liked. I enjoyed the seagull, quite frankly. And I thought the best directed sequence in the movie was the sequence with the drunk guy. That whole sequence where the guy wakes up. Whole sequence where, like, he goes, you don't know what he's going to do when he goes to her bag. You don't know what's going on. And he gets in the water. All that. The buildup is great. And you're right, Eric. And it leads to the best shot in the entire movie. It leads to that close up on her face. And I've always liked Blake Lively. I'm a big fan of Gossip Girl. She's real easy on the eyes. There's a lot of shots of her in a bikini in this movie, which is, you know, very pleasant. And I think she's really good, and she holds her own in this movie. It's a one woman show for like 80% of the film, and I thought the effects were good. They brought the shark to life. It was a fun shark. You know, it likes to eat things and jump up and kill people. And that's what when I go see a movie about sharks eating people, I want them to eat people, and they do, and he does in this movie. So I liked it. I think it's, and again, it's not going to, you know, change the world or anything. It's not one of the best movies of the year, but for a summertime little thriller, I thought it delivered, and I particularly liked Blake Lively, and I thought it was nicely shot. So there you go. All right, next week we are off, guys. I'm taking the day off because it is the 4th of July, and then we'll come back on the 11th. And when we come back on the 11th, we'll review the movies. We'll catch up on, like, the BFG and Swiss Army Man and Legend of Tarzan that come out next week. And but also, guys, we're going to put together our list of the best movies of the year so far, since we're at the six-month mark.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll just put that list together. We won't do a long show on it, but just do top 10 best, top 10 worst so far, and then we'll reveal that on the 11th as well.
Okay.
All right. Cool. Okay. How much time do we have? Okay. Well, Eric, real quick, we don't have time to get through all of this. Finding Dory, $73.2 million. That movie is just, it's huge.
Yeah, it's on its way to becoming the biggest animated film of all time.
Okay. Independence Day Resurgence, evidently, again, 20 years in between movies, nobody cares.
No, didn't make as much as the original did 20 years ago.
Wow. Central Intelligence dropped pretty big, 18.3 million, but will that break 100? No.
No, it actually is. It looks like it's ahead of the pace of other movies that is similar numbers. So not much. It'll be in like the low 100, but it looks like it should get there.
Shallow, $16.7 million. That was expected, right around that kind of number, right?
Yeah. There were estimations all over the place. Some had it as low as 7. Some had it as high as 17. That's kind of where I had it.
Mm-hmm.
So 16 for a $17 million budgeted film,
nice.
That's a solid number.
Okay. And then Free State of Jones, not good, 7.7.
No, $50 million budget.
Okay.
So
not good. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, always a pleasure, you guys, and have a great 4th of July. And Eric, have a great birthday, buddy.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, and we'll talk to you guys on the 11th. Colin, thanks, guys. See you later.
All righty.
Okay.
We'll do it.
There you go. And they are off. We're all off next week for the 4th of July, next Monday morning. I will be off, but we'll be back again for the Monday morning movie reviews on the 11th. Okay? All right. We're going to take a break right now for the news, and then we're going to come back and talk about game shows on 720 WGN.